My name's Randy Youngblood. I'm lead pastor, and I'm so glad that God allowed us to both be here together. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad that I can be with you. We thank God for every person that God brings through the door, because every person through the door is someone he's drawn to himself that he's entrusting to our care, and we never take it for granted every week that the people are going to come back, and yet we pray that God would increase our capacity to care for people, to grow people, and to equip people to know, love, and serve Jesus. If this is your first time, thanks for choosing Thunder Mountain. We know there are a lot of places you could go, you could be, and I'm not just talking about churches, but you've chosen to be here today, and we believe that our gatherings are life-changing encounters with the living God. We started the series last week. Our theme this year is relentless, and we want to be a people that's relentless, that doesn't let any circumstances or difficulty or trials hold us back from following Jesus, that we want to be people that push through, that persevere, that overcome, that don't just take the easy path or the path of least resistance, but people who make a difference in this life. Last week, Justin taught, and my wife often goes TDY on the East Coast. The team that she leads is actually stationed there, and I'm grateful they let her live here. But when she goes out there, she gets usually is there for 2 weeks, and on the weekend in between goes up and sees Kara, Luis, and the grandkids. This last weekend with Luis playing a very important match and Justin teaching, I got to go out for the match and got to get my little grandkid fixed time in. It was really fun. The youngest granddaughter wakes up every morning at 6:30 and calls for Mama, but I'm glad she lets Poppy pick her up, and it was fun. Tuesday was the match, however, and it was a huge match. It was the biggest in Luis's career because it was the semifinals of the CONCACAF Champions League tournament. No American team had ever won the tournament, and they were in the semifinals, and they were playing Chivas of Guadalajara. And the way it works is that the two teams play at each place. They had already played at Guadalajara, and they lost 1-0, and so they needed to win by 2 goals in order to advance to the finals. But what was challenging was that the Chivas fans in Red Bull Arena outnumbered the Red Bull fans like crazy, to the point that when the Red Bulls came on the field, they were booed loudly, which set a lot of tension in the stadium. And so the first half was rough and tumble, 0-0. It looked like their target was going to be to intimidate our top scorer, and they would knock him down, stand over him, and he was down for quite a while, but he kept getting back up. But there was tension in the stands, and it was felt at halftime when people would go to concessions and restrooms and things, and yet at the same time, we realized it's just a game. I opened the door to leave one place and accidentally hit a Chivas fan, and he turned, and I whipped out my Duolingo Spanish and just said, "Lo siento." And I guess it worked because he softened and then asked me where he could find coffee. So international incident averted. But the second half still went scoreless, which meant since we were losing 1-0 entering the match, we lost the semifinal round 1-0. And as the game ended and time expired, the tension began to erupt into fights. And there were fights going on in the stands. So we were trying to get out of the family section, to get behind security, and get down to the family room. When, as I was walking up the stands, one fan, Chivas fan, yelled at a Red Bull supporter across from me and dropped the F-bomb. And I looked at him, and our eyes met, and he looked like he was ready to fight. And he was ready to fight somebody. I was hoping it wasn't me. But just out of, I don't know where, came, "Hey, you guys played a really good game. Congratulations." And his face immediately softened, and an apology came out for the harsh language that he had just used. And it struck me right there again how the scripture is true, that humility receives grace. A harsh word, always a proverb says, stirs up anger, but a soft answer turns away wrath. What is it about humility that can change any relationship on a dime? That can take a fight and make it a friendship. Now, not everything happens so quickly or so abruptly or so easily, But there is a principle here that I want us to look at today. When we talk about the secret sauce of relationships, humility is the key ingredient. Last week, we talked about service. And service without humility is going to give a message of condemnation, and it's not going to be received well. Humility has the ability to change things. I've talked about my struggles in parenting. The two things that I feel like I brought as a parent were prayer and humility. There's nothing I did that I feel made our kids turn out the way they turned out other than prayer and the ability to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. That's what I feel like I brought. And in marriage, I've talked about that. In 2013, I taught a series, Simple, Not Easy, and how when I was a young man, like many young Christian husbands, I knew the scriptures about how my wife ought to respect me. And when I would try to request it, it didn't go so well. And yet I was at Promise Keepers in 1993 and heard a message by Chuck Swindoll, who that was a year he rode in on his Harley. And he delivered the message on Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives like Christ loved the church. And he said, men, do you serve your wives? And I had to say no. And so when I just shut up and began to serve, I humbled myself and served. I found that I began to earn the respect that I had said I deserved. And last week, we talked about service. And service without humility just doesn't work. It's like taking the Spirit of Christ out of your good works. As a young man, I knew the importance of humility, and yet as a young man, it's really hard because as a young person, you're trying to establish yourself, and there's something about being young and wanting to feel established that sometimes the feeling of being established means being feeling superior to someone else, that there's a need within you to feel superior, to give you confidence, and so the need to elevate yourself sometimes works against you. But I would memorize the scriptures on humility, and when I felt like I was struggling, I would try to recall those to see if it would help. But you know what the advantage of being an older man is? Not that I've had those scriptures memorized for all these years. I have memories now. And instead of going to the scriptures of, oh yeah, why should I be humble? It's, oh yeah, because life has a way of humbling us. And God makes a promise that we can humble ourselves or life is going to do it. And God is faithful, and he's also just, and he is able to work through all circumstances to develop in us the character that we need. All of Jesus' disciples learned this lesson. It became the single most transformative ingredient, I believe, in a relationship with Jesus. Jesus didn't choose humble men. So how did they become humble? They became humble because he humbled them, not in a harsh way, but because he helped them understand what a relationship with God was to be like. You see, humility is the reason it is such a critical piece in a relationship, is it works both vertically and horizontally. When we understand or gain a right understanding of our relationship with God and how I relate to him, how he sees me and how I should see him, it also puts into place the piece of the puzzle on how I can relate properly to other people. Jesus didn't choose humble men, but they became humbled through the transformation that naturally occurs with hanging out with Jesus. We're going to look at the writings of Peter. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Peter and how he was a brash, aggressive, confident, bold, even arrogant young man. Jesus called him as a young man, and he called him with a promise. He said, come follow me, and I will make you. Now, I left off the words of what he will make him into, because oftentimes we focus on what Jesus said, follow me and I will do this for you. But let's just look at the verb. And there's a tendency to read into the verb, I will make you, and respond with, oh yeah, nobody makes me. But that's not the point. The point isn't force or coercion. It's not doing something against your will. It's as one of an artist producing something beautiful. He will make, as in produce, something beautiful, powerful, impressive with your life. Jesus said, come follow me, and I will transform you forever. That was the promise. Maybe it's missed or it's overlooked, but it was the promise. it was made, and it was fulfilled. And we see it in every one of his disciples. When Jesus was arrested, they ran, they hid, they locked themselves in an upper room. But when he resurrected and he appeared to them, they were all filled with the boldness and the confidence because of the love and power that he demonstrated that transformed their lives, that where they were willing to die for their faith. Jesus said some pretty heady things about Peter when he was a young man. And many times we hesitate to build others up because of the big head that we think that we will give them. Jesus didn't worry about that. And one time he was referring to Peter, who was called, who's named Simon by birth, and he said, "I tell you that your name is Peter," which means rock. And he says, "On this rock I will build my church." Now keep in mind, he's speaking to Peter in the context of the 12. The 12 who later on would be arguing which of them would be the greatest. Well, Jesus had kind of settled that, but yet it was something that was still caused a struggle. He said, "I will on this rock, Peter, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you," looking at Peter, "the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Some have interpreted that to mean Peter was the first pope. I don't see it that way, but it was nevertheless a heady situation for Peter that I think initially his response was the wrong one. It was like this. He saw himself elevated above others. There is something within every one of us, a pride element that wants to feel validated, in some cases vindicated, to be elevated and be seen as someone special. Peter had been one who would elevate himself above others, but that was going to change. And it changed through a trial. As I said, we can either humble ourselves or life will do it. And Jesus was in the process of letting Peter know life was about to humble you, son, when he was telling them, his disciples, that one of them would betray him. We talked about this 2 weeks ago, and Peter brashly said, "Even if all these guys run away from you, I never will." He saw himself elevated above them. And he said, "Lord, I'm ready to go to the prison or to death for you." He was elevating himself above everyone else. And Jesus said, "I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows in the morning, you won't do that. You're going to deny three times. You're going to fail three times to even acknowledge that you know me." And Peter, at that point, told Jesus that he was wrong. Now, have you ever told Jesus he was wrong? I think we all have told Jesus that we see how we see things differently, and when we do that, we tell him he's wrong, and the outcome is kind of predictable. We're going to look foolish. We can humble ourselves, or life will do it. But let's rewind and ask a different question. What do you think Peter could have said differently at that point instead of, "Oh, yeah"? He could have said, "Oh, really? You're right, I might be wrong, because I am kind of scared inside. I'm afraid, I'm frightened, I really want to, that's my good intention. I want to give my life for you, I want to stand there with you, but there's also this fear and uncertainty." What is it that causes us at those moments that make it so difficult to admit we might be wrong? What is it that causes us to double down, even to Jesus, that, "No, I'm right, you're wrong, Jesus"? Well, by the time morning came, the rooster crowed, Peter went outside and wept bitterly because he had done exactly what Jesus said he would do. And yet, life didn't end, did it? He was restored, he was redeemed, and he was commissioned. Now, fast forward 30 years later, it's the mid-60s AD. Peter, like John, was an older, wiser, now humbler man. John, we remember, we talked about him for weeks. In an earlier series, he grew from being a son of thunder, a man of edge and attitude and maybe anger, given to anger. He was transformed into an apostle of love. Peter, that's everything that we've talked about and more. He's the one, if there was something to be said, he would open up his mouth and stick both feet in it. He's now the apostle of suffering and humility. What causes those kinds of transformations? Well, you take the strengths that Peter had, and you add humility, and you have a person ready to become everything that Jesus prophesied that he would be. Now, let's look at how Peter carried that authority and how he carried it into his relationships with other people. And we're going to see three results of humility. The first result is that humility elevates. Humility elevates others. In chapter 5 in the writings of 1 Peter, he wrote two books, and very creatively, 1 and 2 Peter. Therefore, as a fellow elder, I exhort the elders among you. Now, when I was reading this time, I saw it differently. I saw it, here is Peter, the rock, the one on which I will build my church. And he's writing to elders. He's an apostle, not just an apostle. Some would say the apostle. And now he's talking to unnamed elders, overseers in this small local church, and he's calling them equals to himself. I thought, that's interesting. You know, Peter didn't downplay his credentials. He didn't play the God gave me the keys to the kingdom card, and so I'm telling you how it's going to be, and you're going to listen to me because of who I am. No, many think humility is lowering yourself, but humility is not lowering yourself as much as it's elevating other people to make them equals with you. It's not a false humility. It's a sincere desire to place yourself underneath those that you're serving. Humility is not denying the power you have, but admitting the power that you have comes through you, not from you. This writer in Christianity Today said, if you deny the power you've been given, you lie. If you have gifts and someone compliments you on them, and you say, oh no, not me, you lie. Why is it that it's hard to be complimented? I think it's hard because we understand the tension between pride and humility, and even though we're in the essence prideful people, we at the same time fear it because we know it's dangerous. So when someone says, hey, that was a great meal, it's, oh, no, that was easy. I was nothing. What causes us to downplay the compliment and to really, and let's be honest, insult the complimenter instead of saying, thank you, that's very kind of you, I'm glad you enjoyed it? Or if they compliment you on your voice and say, hey, you should go talk to Jared about joining the praise team, you say, oh, thanks, I enjoy singing for the glory of God, and it does so much for me too. And so you just thank them and then tell them the blessings that you've received from God, that your gratitude. I know when you're working your way into a career, there's the feeling that you want to be successful, and also the fear that you'll think that success is you. But it's humility is recognizing that the power and the blessings come from God, and to enjoy them to the glory of God, and to seek to use them to elevate others. Peter wrote as a fellow elder along with other elders, and when you think about the context, he was understating his own authority, and he was lifting up others to be his equals. And he said, therefore, as a fellow elder, I exhort you elders. He came alongside instead of a top-down guy with a club, do it or else. He came alongside. Instead of a club, it was a hug. And he said, hey, I want to encourage you. Now, notice how humility exercises authority. Peter exhorted, he encouraged, because that's how we receive authority best. That's a funny thing about authority. When it's used well, it's used to benefit other people. He had authority, no doubt, and he gave reason to listen to him. He said, therefore, as a fellow elder, which was an understatement of his authority and a witness to the sufferings of the Messiah, and as a participant in the glory about to be revealed, there's a lot of authority in that verse. But what's it also have to say about relationships? How can you use your authority? You have authority. Every one of us, we're people under authority, and we're people with authority. The authority that we have a responsibility to use it well, regardless of how the people over us use the authority here. There is a tendency to do eye for an eye, that if you, that if you're harsh on me, I'll be harsh on others. But there's nothing in Scripture that says we have to do it that way. Jesus, people treated him harshly. But he continued to be the great elevator, lifter up of others, especially of women. We can encourage when we have the right to demand. We can treat people better than they might deserve. And we can use our position of authority, leveraging our authority to benefit others. You know who's a great example of this? Horst Schultze. He's the former CEO of the Ritz-Carlton, legendary hotel chain that has become the world standard for hospitality. You know, a pet peeve of mine. You know, I don't see how any business, it kind of bugs me, how a business who's, what's their motive? What's the motive of a business? To separate people from their money. How any business can be the standard for hospitality. I want the standard for hospitality to be the church. You know why? Their motive is to separate people from their money. Our motive is to unite people with the living God. But in humility, we studied them to figure out how to do it better. But here's what he did so well, and I believe this was because he was a Christ follower. And Jesus said, the greatest one among you is the one who serves. So what did Horace build into all the servants of the Ritz-Carlton? He built into them not that you're doormats and you need to serve and let people wipe their feet on you so they'll come back. He said, no, you're ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. He elevated the servant to the equal of the guest, and he empowered them. He empowered them in a way that says every one of you has spending privileges up to $2,000 to do whatever it takes to meet the needs of that guest in that moment. You see, humility elevates. Humility, that's the first truth. Humility also inspires. How do you build a team like that out of what's in it for me people? I mean, people go to work to earn a paycheck, to get what they want out of life. So how does someone like Horace Schultze motivate people, turn those what's in it for me people, which we all are, into ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen? Well, he elevates and inspires. You convince people that there will be nothing greater that you could receive than by giving a blessing. You convince people that giving a blessing, you will be blessed more than by anything you could get. And you don't do that by telling. You do it by humbly serving. And not serving without humility, because serving without humility still has a hook, doesn't it? Humility that says, it is my pleasure to serve, is the humility that will inspire and transform lives. He said, as a fellow elder, I appeal to you, care for the flock that God has entrusted to you. He could have really come down with a club here. How could he have said this differently? He said, look, fellas, Jesus gave me the name Rock, and if you don't listen to me, your head's going to roll, and this is how you're going to do it. But he said, no, instead, I appeal to you. I'm one of you. We are fellow elders, which means we have oversight and responsibility for people, precious people to the Lord. And I appeal to you. He could have demanded. He could have said it in many, many different ways. But he said, I appeal to you. Care for the flock that God has entrusted to your care. That even that word entrusted, what does that say if someone entrusts you? They trust you. I remember being in Bible college, and the curfew in the dorm was pretty harsh. It was 10:30 during the week at midnight on the weekends, and they opened up an eightplex, kind of an apartment building of eight apartments that the upper class guys were going to be able to go stay in. And we had visions of going out for pizza and all that kind of stuff at any time we wanted to go. And then the dean sat us down, and he said, okay, guys, I trust you. Dean Walmsley, that's the worst thing you could have said. That just ruined all our plans. We never snuck out. I don't think, maybe. But at that moment, when someone puts trust in you, you want to be worthy of that trust. You want to be faithful. And when he says, the Lord has entrusted people to your care, and I want you to watch over them, willingly, not grudgingly, not for what you can get, but for what, because you are eager to serve God. That's the transformation. That's the transformation that takes people from what's in it for me, what do I get out of this, to what can I give? And he says the difference is your eagerness to serve God. You see, people too have to be able to trust you with their well-being. If people feel you're looking out for yourself, they're going to start looking out for themselves too. And that's where one bad apple can spoil the whole bunch. And this end in a relationship of two people, it only takes one looking out for himself or herself. And then the other person says, everyone for himself. But the truth is that when we serve in a relationship because we're eager to serve God, how can I glorify God in this relationship? It comes through humility. And people, when they feel that you're looking out for their best interests, they will begin to look out for yours. Peter said to those with authority, don't lord it over the people assigned to your care. Don't dance over them as someone who's been given something that you're bragging about. But instead, use that authority to lead them by your good example. John Wooden, among many others over the years, Ronald Reagan, I know this was on his desk, it's amazing how much you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. That kind of attitude is inspiring, and it frees people to do the same. Regardless of how people with authority over you treat you, you and I can be those kinds of people. And that kind of attitude is humility. It's inspiring. It's allowing someone else to take credit that you've deserved, that you've earned. What's going to happen if you let it go? You're going to see in a minute. But the fear is that someone else is going to get the pay raise because someone else is going to get the recognition. Someone else is going to get credit for my good work. But the truth is, if we take a longer-term view, that kind of attitude is inspiring. It's contagious. What relationships matter to you? It's your spouse, your children, your coworkers, your friends. How do they see Christ-like humility? Through you. You see, the only way to inspire greatness in others is to give the example of greatness yourself. And greatness isn't when you elevate yourself. Greatness is when you elevate others and you give credit away. The only way to inspire people to greatness according to Jesus' standard of greatness is to be great through servanthood. I know I've gone on many vacations. My father-in-law, Kim's parents, my father-in-law, I love both my in-laws, and they're very generous people. My father-in-law plans these great vacations about every other year, and it's a means of giving his inheritance to his kids and his grandkids. And I've joked over the years that I'm the dutiful son-in-law that makes sure his daughter and his grandchildren are there, but they love me just like a son. But I've gone to some great places that I haven't paid for much. But one of the things I do get to pay on our cruises are the tips. They leave that to each of us. And it's that opportunity to share Christ, because the thing that I'm able to share, what God put in my heart to share with those who serve and through a tip, is say, because I'm a follower of Jesus, I've learned to value service. Jesus has taught me the one who serves is the greatest on the ship. And I want to honor you. What are some ways that you can exalt servants? How do people see you honoring those who serve? Because they see what's important to you, what gets rewarded by you is going to get replicated from them. Humility inspires. Humility elevates. And humility also precedes blessing. That's the third truth. Humility precedes blessings. Peter wrote in verse 5 of chapter 5, in the same way you who are younger, submit yourselves to your elders. No, when you see that, you have to ask a question. In what way? In the same way. In what way? What's he mean? Well, in the same way he said the older who will serve the younger, not for what they can get because they're eager to serve God. He says you submit back to them in the same way. Not for what you can get, not because, hey, I'm going to submit and you're going to give me a promotion, but no, I'm going to submit to you because I too am eager to please God. And the thing is that God and people who are made in the image of God do the very same thing. It says this. It says, sorry, I said that before I told you what it is they do. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. You know, you want an example of that? Think about yourself as a kid growing up and when your parents did something that they told you you must never do, when you caught them in a lie or caught them doing something, and you confronted them with it and they denied it. What did you do? You're probably, kids are just vicious. If a parent will not admit wrongdoing and tries to cover it up, kids will expose every wrongdoing in your life. God opposes the proud, and people made in the image of God do the very same thing. If you have someone you oversee at work, and you say, hey, I saw you doing this the other day, and I think this is a better way, and they say, no, I didn't do that. I would never do that. And you know that they did, and they say, no, that's not me. You go back and you get more evidence. Once that pride comes up and does not admit the possibility of wrongdoing, you bring more evidence, and that's how garbage collecting comes. Garbage collecting comes sometimes out of necessity when someone looks at you like Peter looked at Jesus and said, no, not me, never. Well, be proud and people will look for your weaknesses. You get to choose. On the other hand, be humble and people will look for your strengths. I was so happy for Nick Foles this last year, winning the Super Bowl. But the real reason, I think, to be happy for Nick Foles was the miles he traveled the humble path. The miles Nick Foles traveled on the humble path prepared him for the success. From the very time he was drafted in the league, he was drafted as a backup to Michael Vick. Michael Vick got hurt, which meant Nick Foles was going to play. Nick Foles, instead of stepping on Michael Vick into the starting lineup, he prayed for Michael Vick. And he didn't hide the fact he was praying for Michael Vick to be healed and to get well and to be able to get back on the field. That's humility. People noticed that, and they noticed it was genuine, that he was elevating others. Well, he played into a Pro Bowl season, 2013. He was a starter in 2014, and then the Eagles traded him in 2015. He started 11 games, and then he was benched. And then he was released. He was signed by another team. He started 3 games. He was benched. He was released. And so then comes 2017. Here's 4 years before, he was a Pro Bowl quarterback. Nobody wanted him. The Eagles took him back as a backup to Carson Wentz. Here's a man who traveled miles on the humble path. You see, every time you and I have a decision, we're at the crossroads can also be summarized as a path of pride and a path of humility. Either I'm going to establish who I think I am, I'm going to convince you of how you should see me, or I'm going to take the path of humility and entrust my future to God. Every choice Nick took, he chose to entrust himself to God. Well, what the scripture says, what did it say? Humble yourself under God's mighty hand, and he will lift you up in due time, so that he may lift you up in due time. That's verse 6. Well, due time came. Nick Foles started 6 games last year, the last 3 of the regular season and all 3 games of the playoffs, and he took the Eagles to a Super Bowl championship. And even then, when he's at the pinnacle of his profession, no higher award, some would say the MVP of the Super Bowl is a higher award than the most valuable player for the season. And when asked the question, what are you going to do now? How are you going to leverage this into a better contract or more playing time? Or are you going to demand to be the starter? He said, no, those things take care of themselves. He didn't mean those things take care of themselves. It means when you humble yourself, God takes care of those things. And Peter said, humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up at due time. And when we humble ourselves, people will look for our strengths. But the question is, when we look at this verse, am I willing to trust God's hand? It says, if I humble myself, God's hand will lift me up. Well, sometimes, a lot of times, we have more confidence in our own hands, don't we? We want our own hands to be in control, to exalt ourselves, to promote ourselves, to build our case for ourselves. But Peter says, And he's someone who's experienced brokenness. He's experienced humility. Even after being told the great things that God was going to do through his life, and he understood that God had great plans, yes, but it wasn't because he was a great man. It had to come because God was a great God, and Peter was humble and understood his place in relationship with God and people. Will you trust God's hand? Will you trust God's timing? Every one of us has a timer that says, okay, God should have responded by now. Now I got no. We got to trust God's hand. We got to trust God's timing if we're people of faith. Our choice is always the choice of the humble path. You know, I had to do this. I told you about the time God had given me a vision for what our church would become, and it's been beginning to become it. But he gave me that vision when we were 30 people, even less than that, when we had 7 people. What I didn't understand is I wasn't the leader that was capable of leading that. Like Peter, I was ready to declare my confidence, but I did not have the competence and the maturity to do it. And if God had blessed then, like now, I would have ruined it. But many times God gives you or me a vision for something he's going to do, and we have to trust that the path is much longer, much more difficult, much more humbling than we ever imagined. Our choice, the only choice that you and I get to make, is to humble ourselves. And when we choose to humble ourselves, then God gets to choose when to exalt us. If we choose to exalt ourselves, he is the one who's going to humble us. But I had summers off. I was teaching, and I took Carissa to a softball tournament in Park City, Utah, and I swung through. There was a church I wanted to visit in Las Vegas, Central Christian Church in Henderson, and we went that Saturday night, and they had a guest speaker. And I thought, oh, man, well, I'm going to listen anyway. And the guest speaker brought this verse, 1 Peter 5:6. Keep in mind, I had left the ministry feeling like a failure, and at the same time, now God was showing me that he had created me to be a pastor, and I was wrestling with guilt. Did I blow it? Did I quit? Was I disobedient? You ever feel like, oh my, I had my chance, and I let it go, and now I'm doomed? That's how I was feeling. And yet here was the message that was brought that night through a guest speaker, and this is what she said. Humble yourself under God's mighty hand, and he will lift you up in his timing. You see, God has a way of speaking the word that you most need when you most need it through the person you may least want to listen to. You realize that? That when there's a word that you really need from God, you got to listen to the people that you don't want to listen to. It may be your spouse. It may be your boss. It may be a subordinate at work. When we're humble, we're able to hear much better. Francis Frangipane said this, I've learned that much of my spiritual progress comes through my ability to humble myself and hear God speak through imperfect people. If you get fixated on their imperfections and say, oh, God can't speak through them. This is a complaint I hear about people who have trouble with the Global Leadership Summit. Those people aren't preachers. Well, who thinks preachers are perfect? We listen. We're willing to listen and learn from anyone. And when we're humble enough to do that, God has a powerful voice to speak. Ezra Taft Benson said, with pride there are many curses, and with humility there come many blessings. When Jesus noticed how the guests were picking the places of honor around the table at dinner, he told his disciples this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, don't take the place of honor, because a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. And if so, that guest, when he comes in, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then humiliated, you will have to take the place of least importance. But when you're invited, take the lowest place on your own, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place, and then you will be honored in the presence of all other guests. And here's the principle. Everyone, for all who exalt themselves, will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Never forget that. When you have a choice between the path of pride and the path of humility, choose the humble path, because the humble path gives God the opportunity to exalt. 1 Peter 5:7 is maybe a well-known verse, but maybe not in this context. Let's put it in this context and see how it looks to us differently. It says, give all your worries and cares to God. What worries and cares? Well, it just followed verse 6. Humble yourself and trust God to lift you up. And all the worries and cares that you have about God's hand not being strong enough, that God's heart not being loving enough, that God's will not being strong enough, that God being not for you enough, that God is not enough, that he won't do it. Give all those worries to God. Humble yourself anyway, because God does care for you. Give all those worries and cares to God, that he won't lift you up, that he won't notice, that he won't care, that he'll do nothing. But be serious, be alert, because your adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a roaring lion looking for someone, anyone he can devour. What's that mean in this context? That means in this context, when you're struggling with God, God may not be there for me. The devil's going to come along and say, you're right, he may. I think he forgot you. He's overlooked you. He's not going to notice you. He doesn't see what you're doing. You deserve credit. You see how the devil will speak to your pride and you will swell up and say, yeah, that's right. God gave me the shaft. And the timer will go off and you'll say, this faith stuff didn't work. I've got to do it on my own. And we choose the path of pride. And we miss the blessing on the humble path. If you elevate people, if you inspire people, I promise you're going to be blessed. They will want you to be blessed, because when people see you exercising your authority for their well-being, they're going to want to see you have more authority. When you exercise your authority for the well-being of those that you manage and care for, they're going to want to see you. They're going to rejoice when you get more authority, because they know it's going to be good for them. They will want to see you exalted. And the good news is that when the chief shepherd appears, he will give you a crown that will not fade. The NBA started the playoffs last night. They're going to crown a new champion, and that crown will fade as soon as the new season starts. Every MVP trophy, the Michael Jordan one, is tarnished. He may be the greatest player of all time, but we know he couldn't play a lick today in his mid-50s. You see, every trophy that you can earn on earth begins to fade as soon as you've received it. But when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive a crown, a trophy, a prize that will never fade away. Jesus elevates, and when he appears, those who follow him are going to appear in his glory with him. Jesus inspires. He came not to be served, but to serve, and he inspires that heart of service in us. And Jesus demonstrated that humility precedes blessing. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death on a cross, and as a result, God highly exalted him and gave him the name above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Why? Because he humbled himself. Blessing always follows humility. Humility always precedes blessing. The result of humility is fear of the Lord, along with wealth and honor and life. And now Peter writes in verse 10 of chapter 5, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ Jesus, he will personally restore, establish, strengthen, and support you after you have suffered a little while. A little while. Timing according to his timetable, exalting to the right place at the right time on the right reasons, because you have chosen the humble path. God says, humble yourself and I will lift you up when you're ready. Who do you want to be in this picture? You want to be that person on the right that says, I could have if I wanted to, but I chose not to, or it was too hard, I didn't want to, or I couldn't win, so I'm not going to try. Do you want to be that other person on the right that says, I'm going to do this myself, so all the glory is mine? I see that in the NBA all the time. People don't want to play, stars want to go be the man on their own team rather than a number two on another. But I hope that we'll be willing to be either or both of those people on the left. People humble enough to accept a hand up when we need it, and people humble enough to lift someone else, elevate above us when they need it as well.